programmed by some white racists. That's what we do. We're flashpoints. We go where people are fighting, where people are being hurt, where people are standing up, and we tell the truth. We speak truth to power. Join us and join this radio station in celebrating our work. 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
If we had been a straight couple, then I would have gotten her Social Security. As it was, I didn't get anything.
Studies show that lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer seniors are much more likely than their straight counterparts to be alone and isolated as they age. Housing and support for these elders is a growing need, and the issue is not just confined to the United States.
From a government's perspective, they are confused about whether to put them in the male or female older people's home.
On this edition, we'll visit Jakarta, Indonesia, and Los Angeles, California, to hear stories of building housing and community for LGBTQ seniors. I'm Jen Chien, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. In recent years, much progress has been made in the fight for the rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. You can see a lot of this shift reflected in popular media.
All this marriage equality news is so exciting. New York.
It's going to be insane. And Isabel's already consulting on like 7 different gay weddings.
It's historic.
From TV shows like Glee and Ellen.
So, on my show, what I like to do is I like to promote kindness and equal rights. And I don't like labels and I don't see color. I'm like a Cocker Spaniel in that way.
To pop stars like Frank Ocean, Scissor Sisters, and Lady Gaga.
Bad religion.
Let's have a kiki.
I wanna have a kiki.
Lock the doors.
Right. Let's have a kiki.
But there's something missing from pop culture's portrayal of the LGBTQ community. With all the shiny young faces on display, LGBTQ elders have been relegated to the sidelines. Many of the cultural and political gains we see today are due to the efforts of a generation that's now aging, often in isolation and obscurity. According to research, LGBTQ elders are twice as likely to be single and 4 times as likely to be childless than their heterosexual counterparts. For those that are partnered, legal discrimination can mean difficulty accessing partner benefits, and many queer elders do not have good relationships with their families of origin. So, as they age, lifelines of support and care can dwindle. Fear of homophobia, discrimination, or abuse can lead many LGBTQ elders to stay isolated, even as they face difficulties with health care and with housing.
Very often, LGBT older adults find that they are not welcome in so-called mainstream aging programs, and so they don't have the sense of community that often comes with group-based social services. We also know, unfortunately, that even within the LGBT community itself, older people often feel isolated and don't find the sense of community that they need.
Michael Adams, Executive Director of SAGE, Services and Advocacy for GLBT Elders, spoke in 2011 at the nation's first summit on LGBTQ housing issues.
We know that, in general, LGBT older folks face particular challenges, and we can lump those challenges into three general areas in terms of stigma, being disconnected from traditional family structures, and in terms of unequal treatment under the law. What all of those factors build toward is, in many cases, particularly heightened sense of an experience of isolation among LGBT older people, which heightens the importance of community and place. So for LGBT elders, it's fair to say that welcoming and supportive housing is not just a luxury, it's in fact a necessity. And it goes beyond the particulars of housing and a roof over one's head into what's important in terms of providing community for many people who, as they age, find that in very short supply.
Awareness of the need for affordable and culturally competent care is growing, with housing developments for LGBTQ elders in the works in multiple cities. We go now to Los Angeles, where in 2007, a nonprofit called Gay and Lesbian Elder Housing built the nation's first affordable housing development for LGBTQ seniors. It's called Triangle Square. Reporter Lena Nozizwe visited the five-story apartment complex, and she brings us this story.
Hello, Rosie.
It's snack time for Rosie. And to the casual observer, this domestic scene between a doting cat owner and her fat and furry feline is nothing more than ordinary. Only the blonde-haired woman with a twinkle in her eye and cat food in her hand believes it's more like a miracle.
My name is Alice Hope Herman. I'm 77 years old. I lived with my partner, Sylvia, for 45 years. She died 3 months, almost to the day, before I found my home here at Triangle Square.
Triangle Square in Hollywood, California, is the country's first affordable housing complex designed specifically with lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, or LGBT, seniors in mind. It was built in 2007, just a couple of blocks away from the fabled intersection of Hollywood and Vine. The 10-year waiting list to get a spot at Triangle Square is not surprising, considering that there are an estimated 3 million LGBT seniors 65 years or older in the United States. That number is expected to grow by another million by 2030, numbers that only highlight the need for places like Triangle Square.
That's Sylvia when she was younger.
Very Audrey Hepburn.
Triangle Square is not at all where she imagined that she would end up back in the mid-60s when an uptown Alice began a relationship with a downtown Sylvia in New York City.
When Sylvia and I started out, she had pretty much grown up from the time she was around 17 in Greenwich Village. She knew the bar scene. She used to go out with the guys in the mafia. I didn't know there were gay people in Greenwich Village. I didn't know what a gay person was. I got married. Okay. And I married my high school sweetheart. And 2 years after we were married, I realized I was gay, but I didn't know what it meant. So I was what they called uptown, because I went to college. I went to libraries. Sylvia went to after-hours clubs and bars. I mean, the two completely different worlds. I gave her what she needed, which was stability. To her, I was like a rock. To me, she was like a cloud.
The cloud spent a lifetime ascending in the business world and became a successful chief financial officer in the garment district, while the rock, Alice, was a teacher and then a social worker. She says they were successful enough that after 40-plus years together, they managed to put $500,000 in the bank, and she says they created a beautiful home in L.A.'s San Fernando Valley. But then in 2007, Sylvia fainted in their home and was hospitalized.
And what she would have to say to me is, Alice, just let me come home, please. I just want to come home.
This couple, who had already been together in sickness and in health, got married by a rabbi in the hospital. Days later, Sylvia died.
If we had been a straight couple,
then I would have gotten her Social Security, which I could say was more than twice as much as mine, which is what you get when you're a straight couple. The partner gets the higher of the two checks. As it was, I didn't get anything.
Hospital bills decimated their savings. Alice was forced to leave the home they shared, and given her age and income, it was difficult to find housing. But then through word of mouth, she found out about Triangle Square, and it was exactly what she was looking for. She says it's safe, affordable, and allows her to keep the cats, including Rosie, that she once shared with her beloved Sylvia.
My birth name is Wayne, and I go under Miss Rosie. I am transgender, and I live at Triangle Square, and I am 72 years old.
Another Rosie, more specifically, Miss Rosie, also found shelter at Triangle Square. It was not the death of a partner, but intolerant neighbors who brought Miss Rosie to Triangle Square, also in 2007. The transgender senior got tired of sneering neighbors.
I lived over near Gower and Hollitt and Sunset. And I was there for 30 years. But when I'd go get dressed up in my apartment and walk down the hall, I'd get looks and sneered at and everything. And, you know, it just made me feel uncomfortable.
Once she moved into Triangle Square, she immediately felt at home. Her one-bedroom apartment is now complete with enough wigs to make Dolly Parton envious.
Right here is my little short one here that's my Susan Boyle look.
And there are his and hers closets.
One female closet and one male closet.
I have a hard enough time with just a female closet.
The kind of acceptance Miss Rosie has found at Triangle Square, no matter what she wears, has been a long time coming. That was not the case where she grew up in Indiana.
When I was a child, I used to dress up my mom's clothes up in the attic. And sometimes I'd get punished by my parents, and then I would get mad. And I said, well, I want to run away home to become a woman, you know, and disappear as a man.
As it turns out, she grew up and ran away to the military. She didn't have the Susan Boyle wig back then, so it was with a mop on her head that she impersonated a woman during an Army talent show. And she won. In 1964, after 5 years of military service, Miss Rosie decided to make the full transition to living as a woman after a visit to a bar.
I was telling the barmaid about the situation I did in the Army. She said, come over to my house and I'll dress you up. And when she dressed me up with the real makeup, real hair, the whole works, I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, oh my God, this is really me. I thought I was just an ordinary homosexual or queer at that time. I did not even know the word what gay was, you know, or transgender or anything like that.
Miss Rosie says there weren't many jobs in the 60s for a newly minted woman, and that's what she says led her to the streets of San Francisco.
In this dirty old part of the city.
And when I was doing this, while I was going through the transitioning, I had no job, and I was a prostitute back in the 60s. And guys that I'd pick up thinking I'm a real woman.
Now, my girl, you're so young and pretty.
And then when they get down to the nitty-gritty, they would find out that I'm a man, and I've had guns on me, I've had knives pulled on me. It's a wonder I'm still alive today.
She survived San Francisco and then Los Angeles until she says she quit prostitution after a police beating during a bust. In 2001, she would face another serious threat to her life, HIV.
Is I take 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pills per day at one time in the mornings.
And just as Miss Rosie survived the streets, she says she will survive HIV.
I am not going to let HIV or anything to stop me from doing anything that I want to do.
As many as a third of the apartments at Triangle Square are devoted to seniors who are HIV positive. Because of their health status, those seniors get preferential treatment when they apply to be residents. The nonprofit Gay and Lesbian Elder Housing, or GLEH, runs Triangle Square and provides other services there, including nutrition guidance, financial planning, and recreational activities.
I've given activities that based in community. We go to the theater, we go wherever, go to museums and to Chinatown or wherever, or to the beach, you know. And it's, a person has to have a link so that their mind stays alive.
The Link to Life on this night is a gathering of Triangle Square residents, supporters, and administrators.
Well, welcome everybody.
The event is focused on fundraising, but it is also an opportunity for Eric Harrison, the executive director of GLEH, to celebrate the pioneering success of Triangle Square.
You know, we have had such a tremendous amount of support this past year.
Resident Alice Herman shows just how important Triangle Square is to her as she mixes and mingles with the fundraising crowd and tries her luck at the community room's pool table.
Did you get it in?
These places are needed. It's hard to get old in many ways. It's more difficult to be old and gay, especially when you've lived a life where you've been hurt because you were gay, where you've been frowned on or hurt or beat up or arrested. Look at the things that have happened to people. At least here they can walk through the halls and know they're safe.
This is a beautiful place, just a beautiful place to be, you know?
Ms. Rosie, who's lived through arrest and beatings, says she never wants to leave this safety zone.
And this, I'm hoping that this will be the last place I ever be, because I love this place.
I get to tell my story over and over again. When you get to be my age, or maybe even when you're younger, you've got a history, you've got a life. The one person you shared your history with is no longer there. What happens to the history? What happens to the life I had? How does it stay alive if it's only inside me, in my head? Here I get to tell my story.
Alice and Miss Rosie are sharing their histories in a place that's making history of its own. For Making Contact, I'm Lena Nozizwe.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear about a unique housing project for transgender seniors in Jakarta, Indonesia.
If you'd like more information or for a CD copy of this program, please call 510-251-1332, extension 108. That's 510-251-1332. Extension 108. Because of generous donations from listeners like you, the show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or to get our podcast, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
We'll head now to Indonesia, where just as in the U.S., LGBTQ elders face unique challenges as they age. Traditionally, elderly people in Indonesia are cared for by their families, but that's not the case for the country's large transgender community. They're often rejected by their family members, and many elderly transgender people who used to survive as prostitutes end up begging on the streets. In response, a group of women decided to take action and are building a home specifically for elderly transgender residents. From Jakarta, Rebecca Henschke reports. This story was originally broadcast on Free Speech Radio News.
We're walking down a dirt road up to a very small pink house at the end of the alleyway. It's a very suburban part of Jakarta, on the outskirts of the city. There are chickens running around and children playing, and it's a very dusty road. It's here that Indonesia's first old people's home for transgender people, or waria as they're known in Indonesia, is being built.
Selamat pagi.
Selamat pagi. Selamat siang.
In the doorway, two elderly transgender women whose teeth are missing call out good morning. Inside, Juliana Sretteblout is looking into a mirror while a friend is going through the daily ritual of applying her heavy makeup. Thick white foundation, fake eyelashes, bright red lipstick and a long black wig that is tied into a bun at the back.
Saya sendiri mengetahui saya waria itu sekitar saya kelas 5 SD.
I realized that I was a transgender person when I was in grade 5 at school. I lived in a village in an isolated area on the island of Papua. There was no one there that was transgender or gay. But suddenly, I started feeling attracted to men when I was around 11 years old. I thought, what is this feeling? Is it an illness? It was not till I was 18 years old when a friend at university, who was also transgender, took me to Jakarta to the prostitution beat for waria, that I realized that there was this whole other world that existed. I was so confused. There were so many people like me dressed up so beautifully.
How did you feel when you realized you were not alone?
I felt like weight had been lifted from me because I saw that if we wear beautiful clothes and got makeup, you could easily attract guys and be paid money for it. So you get satisfied, get to be beautiful, and you earn money.
Transgender people in Indonesia find it hard to find jobs. And 17-year-old Yuli ended up doing what many other warriors do, working as a prostitute on the streets, a world she says was harsh and violent. She says she was regularly abused and not paid by customers, and they had to run away from the police or Islamic vigilante groups that tried to beat them. It was during this time that she heard her parents had died.
Mereka dengar kabar bahwa saya sekarang udah ikut-ikut pakai-pakaian perempuan, taukannya. Saya pikir bahwa
I didn't go home for the funeral because my family hated me.
Saya tidak pulang karena
they said because of what I had done, my parents had died.
Orang tua akhirnya meninggal. Saya akhirnya bertemu ibu setelah saya pulang dan kakak saya memang kebetulan kan
my brother is a policeman. He was very angry and he wanted to shoot me because he said I had shamed my family. They said in our family we have never had anyone like you. How could you turn out like this? Because my family had high hopes for me because I got very good grades all through school.
Musnah karena gara-gara aku jadi seorang waria.
Your brother was really prepared to shoot you?
Aku ditaruh pistol di sini mau ditembak.
Yes, he's put a pistol to my head and he wanted to shoot. They shaved my head, but I managed to run away back to Jakarta. I really hated myself at that time and I decided that I would spend the rest of my life showing the world and particularly my family that even though I'm transgender, I can do good and they would be proud of me.
She went on to be the first waria to gain a law degree at a leading Islamic university and is now doing her master's in law. She's now a high-profile leader of Indonesia's large transgender community, who fondly call her Mama Yuli. As a mother to the community, she decided she needed to do something to support graying waria, rejected by their family and society.
Orang akan memang merasa lebih takut.
As they get older, people become even more scared of waria. We can't sell ourselves in the same way young waria can. From a government's perspective, they are confused about whether to put them in the male or female older people's home. And the families certainly do not want to look after them. So I see many of them struggling, begging on the streets, living under bridges. I really feel sad seeing them like that.
Aku sedih melihat mereka seperti itu dan penanganan.
And no one is paying attention to this issue. And my house was not big enough to house many.
Yang jelas.
So she's now renovating her two-bedroom house that also doubles as a beauty salon. Yuli takes me out the back of the house where building is taking place. A second floor is being put on and the bathroom is being extended. She already has a waiting list of 800 waria who want to move in. At the moment, the house is home to three elderly waria. Photos of them as young, beautiful models line the walls, and cabinets are full of their beauty pageant trophies. Yoti Maya is nearly 70 years old and has lost all her teeth. She was disowned by her family when she was a teenager.
Tu ibu buka pintu ada laki dalam waktu lagi peluk-pelukan. Ibu tu enggak mau ribut, bilang ke ayah saya.
My mother opened my door and found me in bed cuddling with a man. And she told my dad, and he called all my family together and said, I don't want this in my family, so you must leave the house now. If you lived or died, I don't care. You just have to get out of the house.
Kamu keluar dari rumah aku. Dari usia 16-17 tahun saya keluar sama si Mia tuh. Saya keluar dari rumah.
I was just a teenager and they threw me out of the house at night with nothing but the clothes I was wearing. I was crying. I was young and I didn't have a job. But I accepted my fate.
Yoti says she eventually found work as a chef on ships and has traveled across Asia. She's now the cook for the nursing home. The home also holds training sessions for elderly transgender people so they can get skills to live independently.
Hello, nama saya Mbak Sri.
73-year-old Mbak Sri teaches sewing and warns the younger warrior that they can't live off their looks forever.
I tell them all young warrior need to get formal education in their chosen field. No one else is going to be looking after us. We need to create our own profession and provide for ourselves.
Sri says the three of them, despite their age, remain young at heart. She jokes that Yoti Maya has four boyfriends, and they hold a weekly karaoke night where the elderly warrior take turns performing their favourite tracks. Yuli's positive contributions to the community are making an impact beyond the transgender community. Recently, her brother, who had threatened to shoot her, visited the old people's home.
He did not come in, but just walked around and he started to cry. He said, I never thought you would change and become a good person. It doesn't matter that you are a warrior, but you have become a role model for your community and you're providing a home for those in your community in need. Our family is very proud of you, he said.
Terus dia bilang bahwa
we couldn't accept you as a prostitute, terjadi, but you have become terjadi, a good person.
Aku sebagai kakaknya juga bangga. Seperti itu. Dan kemudian
he said that the past was the past, but as a brother, I'm very proud of you. A few days later, I had my law graduation, and he came along. He couldn't say anything at the celebration. He couldn't speak because he was just crying. Not long after that, he died. I went to his funeral, and he had left me a message that I must continue to be a good person.
Yuli, Yoti, and Sri continue their efforts to support aging transgender people, and recently they received a grant from the Indonesian government so that they could complete the first floor of the old people's home. In Jakarta, Indonesia, I'm Rebecca Henschke.
Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News for that last story.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You've done it for this fun drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. So Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories. The site is kpfk.org and there's a donate button. You are listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. Hey, oh,
hey, yeah. Hi, I'm Andrea Martin. You might forget me from the 80s. KPFK is listener-supported public radio in Los Angeles that refuses to take money from corporations. They didn't refuse, however, to take money from me, and all I have left to show for it is a biodegradable tote bag to store all my other biodegradable tote bags in, and a bumper sticker, which they happily said was mine to enjoy. If only I hadn't donated my car to KPFK, I would have a bumper to stick it on. So please join me in showing your support by calling 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KAPUFKA or online kpfk.org. I'm Andrea Martin, and trust me, all the money you give goes directly toward keeping the lights on, and in my estimation, should be dimmer because these carpets haven't been cleaned since the 80s, which you might forget me from.
Hi, I'm Ashley Judd, and I believe that when we listen collectively, change happens. And I believe we should listen to girls and women. I believe that girls and women should speak for themselves, with and for each other, about their bodies, their rights, and their dreams. That's why I think woman-made media is so important, and why we all need to tune in to Feminist Magazine on KPFK.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
After decades of restrictions to abortion across this country, people continue to find ways to make this vital procedure safer, more affordable, and more accessible. Remember what women have done in the past when abortion was illegal. And check in on today's movement facilitating abortions that are self-managed at home. We're not giving out medical or legal advice in this program. Instead, we're sharing an important history and new developments in abortion options. First, we bring you our adaptation of a piece by Hannah Nguyen and State of the Human. It's a look back at the Jane Collective of 1970s in Chicago, told by the Janes themselves. Officially known as the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation, these women offered safe, affordable, and friendly abortions when the practice was still illegal, and the alternatives were much more dangerous than today.
It was just like a powder keg. It was ready to go off.
We were so foolish that we weren't even afraid of getting caught.
I was 20 years old. I was really a kid. I was scared to death. We all were. We were all scared. None of us wanted to go to jail.
If we're at risk, we're all at risk.
May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us. There were women screaming. There were women yelling. They asked us, what are you in for? And we said, abortion. And they said, ooh.
We'll hear arguments in number 18, Roe against Wade.
In the absence of abortion,
are legal, medically safe abortions, women often resort to the illegal abortion. And in fact, if the woman is unable to get either a legal abortion or an illegal abortion in our state, she can do a self-abortion, which is certainly, perhaps, by far the most dangerous.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women.
I'm Judith Arcana. I'm a writer, a teacher, and of course, I'm a Jane. I got involved because in the summer of that year, 1970, I thought I was pregnant. I knew that at that time in my life, having a child would be terrible for the child and not good for me either. And so I thought, okay, I'll have to get an abortion. And one of the people that I thought of to ask was a medical student in Chicago. So I called him up. He said, everybody here says, call this number and ask for Jane. I called the number. A woman called me back. She said her name was Jane. Turns out, of course, it wasn't. Everybody said that. Soon I was one of the people saying that on the phone. As it happened, I was not pregnant. And so I called her back to say that I wouldn't need an abortion that time. And she said, we're taking in new people in the fall, and it sounds like you might be interested. Yes, as a matter of fact, I think I am.
I really felt that abortion rights were the front line of women's rights because women were literally dying. Jean Gallitzer Levy, I'm 66 years old. When I was 20, I was a member of the Abortion Counseling Service. Women were dying from back alley abortions, but they were also dying because they were denied basic medical services that should have been available. Women would go to the hospital with natural miscarriage. And because there was such a stigma to abortion, they would be turned away. Women died of miscarriage during this period. We were a varied group. There were young housewives, people who were older, college students. Everybody coming into the service was trained as a counselor. And you would pick a woman, you would call her, you would set up a time for her to come over, give her a cup of tea, you know, like you would host anyone. And then we would explain what the procedure was. It was enormously empowering. What would happen, you know, this woman would come in, she had this terrible problem, which had the potential to make a complete mess of her life. You know, what she saw in front of her was disaster. And in 20 minutes, that was gone. That mess, that disaster that was sitting right here in her life was gone. And her life was in front of her. It was enormously empowering. And for many, many women in the service, it was the first time they'd really taken control of their lives. It just felt great.
Abortion Counseling Service was a context in which to put my ideas about how society should be. So yes, of course it was a politicizing situation, no two ways about it.
My name is Martha Scott. I live in Chicago and have lived here many, many years.
I was a counselor at the Abortion Counseling Service when I had my first abortion, and then much later on I had an abortion again, and that was done by a woman I knew. Yeah. It should be just a normal possibility. It's not what you necessarily choose first. But if, in fact, it's what you need, it's what you need. When you see yourself as a person who is extended around a family, then if you do political work, then you see yourself as a person extended around a much larger entity. Or you're living in a way that maybe makes a difference to the world. That changes you. We were pretty ordinary people. Smart, competent, whatever. But pretty ordinary. And we did a very extraordinary thing. And we did this extraordinary thing because we had a goal and a vision and a group.
By the turn of the year was when we also began to learn medical practice.
Started to lean on our guy, teach us, teach us, teach us. And little things started to happen. He would let us come in to assist, which really meant in the beginning, sit there beside the bed because it was in somebody's apartment. You know, there was no operating table. Sit down, hold her hand,
stroke her brow, give her some water to drink, whatever, you know, to be comforting. The first time I was allowed to come in blew my mind. It was constant. We did this every week, several days a week. Dozens of women came on those days for abortions. That's what had to get done. I was absolutely drawn to it. Like I said, I walked in, I saw it, I thought, whoa, this is the real deal. Look at this. And also, I think there was an element of learning to do and be competent at something that was important and valuable in women's lives. Of course, now we are practicing medicine without a license. Because, of course, when abortion is illegal, it's not medicine. Actually, what it is felony homicide, which is very scary. May 3rd, 1972, in fact, the Chicago police from a precinct that we did not work in busted us.
So I was working the front. I was sitting and talking to a woman who was very nervous. She had come with her sister. It turned out that she was the person who had turned us in. I really resent that. Later, I heard a knock at the door. So I went down the corridor and opened the door. And there were the two tallest men I'd ever seen in my life. And all I remember is seeing them. And then I turned around and I walked down the corridor in front of them without saying anything to them. I got into the room and I said, "These are the police. You do not have to say anything." They were furious and they arrested me.
If I thought I knew how the system worked, now I knew how the system worked. At this point, I'm 28 or 29 years old. I'm married. I have a tiny child. I've been arrested. My dad says, "You know, your mother had an abortion." And I was just blown away, not because she did, but because I said, "No, Dad, I didn't know that. Nobody ever mentioned that." And of course, I mean, if she had lived, and if she had been the mother who raised me, she may very well have talked to me about it. I'll never know. So my dad told me the story of my mother's abortion. I loved it. I mean, I don't wish unwanted pregnancy on anyone. Never in a million years would I. However, I loved the fact that this work that I was doing could have been. I can't believe I feel this. All these years later, but it still makes me choke. I could have been of use to my mother, my own mother, who was so young. Law and justice are not the same thing. There are many unjust laws. There always have been, there always will be. So I am not one who respects the law. The service was an enormous influence on my development as a human. And certainly, of course, as a woman.
Being a mother is really important to me. I wanted to be a mother, and I was, but I got to choose when, and I got to choose how. As a result, I was able to have the children I wanted and raise them the way I wanted to.
You, as someone who doesn't believe in this, have really no reason to tell me, who does feel it's appropriate, that I can't do it. You have your own choices. Those are legitimate choices. Good luck to you, should you be pregnant for the fourth time or tenth time and you don't want to have that baby. Your point of view does not impinge on, should not impinge on mine. And I'm not telling you to have an abortion, and you shouldn't be telling me not to.
I think that January 22nd, 1973 would be an historic day.
Good evening. In a landmark ruling, the Supreme Court today legalized abortions. The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision to end a pregnancy...
We thought, well, this is a battle we've won. No, of course, it's absolutely not true.
In this instance, the Supreme Court has withdrawn protection for the human rights of unborn children.
It's unbelievable. I would not have expected this. I thought we had gotten past it.
The House is moving forward with a plan to ban abortions after 20 weeks.
I would not have expected this, the assault that's going on women's health care. And we're looking at an assault on birth control, on basic preventative care, on health care for anybody who can't sort of circumvent repression.
You know, I've been participating in the March for Life for years, and there's one thing that had always struck me, and that is the vigor and the enthusiasm of the pro-life movement.
It isn't about population, it isn't about fetuses, it isn't about any of that stuff. It is really about controlling women. The fewer options women have, the less control they have. Women who have control are kind of threatening to the people who make these decisions, I guess. I mean, nobody wants to give up their power.
I don't see women sitting down and saying, okay, do what you want. I think women are going to be the backbone of the resistance. This is a generation of women who were consciously told they could do anything, they could have anything, they were human beings. And then in every kind of subtle and not so subtle undercurrent, they were told the opposite. I think we're sitting on another powder keg.
The Jane Collective performed approximately 11,000 abortions. They were arrested by the police one time in 1972. But their case was dismissed after the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court judgment made abortion legal throughout the United States on January 22, 1973. When people use phrases like on their own terms or outside of a clinic, they're referring to self-managing abortions. Unfortunately, most of the general public are not aware of the option of self-managed abortions. There are a variety of methods for self-managing, most of which are safe and reliable, often just using simple herbs or medicines. Many advocates say the focus needs to be on decriminalizing those options for all people, whether there's a clinic accessible or not.
People will end their abortions outside of clinics, and helping them do so safely or as safely as possible is part of the way that providers think about what they're doing. So self-induced abortion is explicitly illegal in Arizona and six other states: Delaware, Idaho, Nevada, New York, Oklahoma, and South Carolina.
So those are the states where self-managed abortion is explicitly illegal. But people have been arrested in other states where conservative prosecutors can charge people with the unlawful practice of medicine or use so-called feticide laws to prosecute people who have or assist with self-managed abortions.
So even if there's a state that doesn't explicitly ban self-induced abortion, because prosecutors have their own personal beliefs about abortion, they're increasingly using things that might not seem like they connect as charges to prosecute people. But there are many different ways that prosecutors can and have investigated and brought charges against and incarcerated people for self-induced abortion. This great organization in the Bay Area called the SIA Legal Team has identified 40 different types of laws that could be used to prosecute someone for self-induced abortion or for helping someone end their own pregnancy. They really vary. So there's procuring a miscarriage, which sounds very arcane, but is still illegal in some places. People have been investigated and prosecuted for failing to report a death to the coroner, for misusing fetal remains. Prosecutors sort of throw charges at the wall to see what sticks, like pasta. Over the last 8 years, since the 2010 midterms, there have been sort of a record number of anti-abortion legislation passed across the country. Hundreds of laws have been introduced and many of them passed, and they've really run the gamut in the ways in which they restrict abortion. But, you know, they either limit when you can get an abortion, so, or they make it harder for providers of abortion to do their jobs by requiring that they, you know, have hallways a certain width, or that they meet with their clients or patients several times before offering the abortion. Trump's election sort of solidified this idea that access to abortion in clinics was sort of had reached its peak and was going to decrease, access would decrease going forward. And one of the promises that Trump made during his campaign was that he would actually overturn Roe v. Wade and would basically make getting abortions illegal. So what does abortion look like when it's no longer legal, and also when it's effectively not legal and available because of these restrictions?
If abortion becomes illegal, more people will probably turn to in-home abortions. Fortunately, self-managed methods have improved greatly over the past decades. And now, as in the past, there's a growing movement of brave folks building a network to share knowledge and support.
When we look at the underground abortion movement on a worldwide level, what we see is women rising to the needs of anyone that desires reproductive freedom. When you have a pregnancy and you cannot handle that and you need to terminate it, you need to be able to do that. The reason that right now there's more action is because people don't trust the state. We have so much legislation. What we just saw in Texas with the closure of abortion centers, we see an onslaught of hatred and anti-abortion legislation that has been exceedingly positive for them. We are not winning. The reason women are gathering is because we've been losing ground. I think it's very important as a feminist revolutionary that we recognize that we are living in fascist times, and that it has always been so that we have been under control as women, or trying to be under control. But I have to say that we live in one nation under surveillance, and that it's very important that we proceed carefully, cautiously, and recognize that we must step forward. This is not the time for passivity. The earth depends on us taking action and making a stand. If you're sitting on the fence right now, you really just have a stick up your ass. You've got to make a decision and take a step. And learning about your body and taking responsibility for yourself, for your reproductive health, that is revolutionary. So welcome to the team, because the world needs you, and we need knowledge to be shared, not controlled.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button, or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org. or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times, and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine, and that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. We mentor new contributors here on Feminist Magazine. We love doing that. We love teaching radio skills like interviewing, engineering, and editing to young college students, to grassroots feminists from different communities across the city. And all of us who are part of the show are activists in different communities around LA, but we give our time and sweat to FemMag because we believe in radio. Go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer, and that is amazing. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. And all through this past lockdown and pandemic, we have all kept going remotely for you. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! In-depth news coverage is becoming a rare commodity in today's media landscape. There's a straightforward reason. It's no longer profitable for commercial media. Serious journalism is expensive. It takes time to prepare. It requires a large and talented team of researchers, reporters, editors, and producers. That's why listener-supported news and information on KPFK is more important than ever. We continue to bring you comprehensive coverage from skilled, dedicated journalists because you continue to support the work we do here all year round. Please continue to support KPFK, all the vital work that's done at this Pacifica station. Call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK and join the KPFK Sustainer Circle, or you can give at kpfk.org.
That's what is good about KPFK. You do get it, that it's the people, not the manufacturers that are selling us all the cheap soap and toothpaste and general unhealthy junk. But it's really information that is quite usable. I'm Joyce Clark from Bellingham, Washington. I listen to KPFK as much as I possibly can, and I do support it.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and if you're in Bellingham or anywhere else in the world, www.kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Marcy Winograd, co-producer of Code Pink Radio, Mondays, 4 p.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. I also report from Santa Barbara for KPFK's Rebel Alliance News. I've had a relationship with KPFK for decades. I can remember my mother frantically calling me up at 2 a.m. in the morning, wanting to know what I was doing. I was still at KPFK editing a piece, a documentary on the coup in Chile, when thousands of people were rounded up in the stadium during a very ugly chapter in history funded by the CIA. We are lucky, we are fortunate to have KPFK in Los Angeles, and I hope that you also appreciate what KPFK has to offer, basically the truth that you don't hear on corporate media. So please do support KPFK. Give us a call. Make a pledge. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK. Or donate online at kpfk.org. Thanks so much for your support.
Support comes from Art Don't Sleep and Jazz Is Dead, presenting the nine-piece jazz funk collective Ghost Note on June.